back when I was growing up, you'd be told you're weird. Adults would tell you, you're weird, you're so strange. Would you just stop it with all the weird noises? And can you just settle down? And my God, you're stressed all the time. Just take a chill pill. And you would start to think there's just something desperately wrong with me. I'm built broke. I'm built broken.
This is Reinvent Yourself with Dr. Tara Swart-Bieber. Conversations on neuroplasticity, the science that proves every brain, even your brain, can change, no matter your mindset or stage in life. Each episode, Dr. Tara leads compelling conversations with familiar voices to explore how anyone, even you, can reinvent yourself. And now, here's Dr. Tara.
Before we dive into today's conversation, I'm very excited to let you know about two upcoming episodes of Reinvent Yourself with Dr. Tara. If you're one of the many people who make New Year's resolutions that quickly fizzle out, and you want to know why, these episodes are for you. You need a grasp on the science of neuroplasticity and how to make it work for you. So for the first two episodes of the new year, my good friend and producer of this podcast, Mark Steele, is going to interview me about neuroplasticity. We're going to take a look back at the fascinating conversations we've had throughout 2022 and break down the science as it applies to you. So this year, resolve to reinvent yourself. Join us on January 11th and 25th, two very special episodes of Reinvent Yourself with Dr. Tara that you won't want to miss. And now, on with today's conversation. Today's guest has been producing, directing, and writing for film and the stage for 30 years, working with some of the world's best visual artists to blend the mediums of live action and animation in order to engage audiences with compelling truth. The writer of hundreds of published and produced works, he has also found success as an author, speaker, and comedian. His most recent book is the collection of fictional short stories entitled The Most Important Thing Happening, and he is currently the executive director of intellectual property at Knox Studios. I'm super excited about today's episode with Mark Steele, who is a personal friend of mine and family man. Mark Steele, how are you today?
I'm great. That was very generous, and I love how you capped it off with family man. I try for sure.
Well, you have a large family, and I'd love to hear a bit about them as we go through the conversation. But the way that I wanted to start today was ask you, Mark Steele, who were you before the Mark that I see before me today?
That's interesting. That's, you know, I've had a lot of conversations with you, and you've started to really pull out this side of my introspection. It's been a long time since I really looked at the dichotomy, if you will, of what I am now and what I remember very vividly starting off with. I think it's important to start off saying I do have a wonderful family. Two of my four children are on the autism spectrum, and that's a diagnosis that did not exist when I was growing up. So there's no certainty whether or not I was on the autism spectrum myself, but boy, as I've walked through that journey with my own kids, I have questioned many, many times if perhaps that's what was going on with me and if perhaps my pathway would have been clearer with definition because, you know, I am now an individual who has to do a lot of public speaking or at least public presentation, pitching ideas, be a director on set. I have to give very clear artistic instruction, I have to speak the language of cameramen, lighting people, makeup people, actors. And obviously all of that requires a great deal of communication skill. Growing up, it is to put it lightly that I had no communication skill. I was filled with anxiety as a young person. I grew up with a terrible stutter and with all sorts of little habits. I would make little sounds. I would clear my throat constantly. They were all nervous tics. And if you looked at me back then, you would certainly say, this is not an individual who's going to thrive in a public space, certainly not as a front man, and absolutely not as a voice or a spokesperson. And I've always said that I think the greatest gift I was given in life was that I was a very good storyteller from a young age, but I was terrible, and I'm not exaggerating, I was terrible at everything else. Everything wasn't a good student, wasn't a good athlete. And that, to me, that was a gift because I had such clarity of what I wanted to do. And I had clarity that it was the only thing I could ever be great at. The reason that was a gift is then that forced my hand to say, well, if you're going to do that, there's a lot of aspects to doing that that you don't know how to do, and you have anxiety over doing, and you have a long way to go to be able to do. You know, because it was pretty clear from then, if I'm going to make my own stories, I have to get people excited about my stories, and I have to be able to stand up and tell my stories. And so that's the enormous difference. I knew at that young age, and I'm talking 11, 12 years old, I knew I had a lot to overcome. But because I was single-minded, ism spectrum, or any of those things.
Wow, Mark, it's so hard to imagine you being like that, given, you know, in the time that I've known you, you're so eloquent and articulate and funny. I think it's a really great example for people who may have experienced something like that themselves and maybe not overcome it to the extent that you have, or have a child that's struggling with that right now and wondering if their child can really make such a big turnaround. So thank you so much for sharing that. A few thoughts came into my mind about the mechanisms of neuroplasticity that underlie that. So I'd just like to share that with our audience.
Yes, please.
In the four-step process of reinventing yourself, the first step, which I always think is about 50% of the battle, is raised awareness. Mm. So it was really interesting to hear how strongly aware you were that this is the thing, this is my purpose, this is the thing I'm going to do, and trying to understand what you had to do to then get to the point that you could live that purpose. The process which I speak about in pretty much every episode is then followed by focused attention, deliberate practice, and accountability. And focused attention is looking for opportunities where you could have done something differently, like not been so anxious, not cleared your throat, or like not avoided a particular situation. And deliberate practice is actually going out there, telling those stories, winning people around, putting yourself, you know, in those positions where you can build up your confidence. And usually accountability has to come from elsewhere because, you know, we're never as sort of hard on ourselves as, let's say, a personal trainer is in the gym, for example.
Yes.
But it sounds like you had a lot of self-motivation to that, which is really inspiring as well. The actual physiological mechanisms for neuroplasticity are either that you connect up neurons that already exist, and it sounds like that storytelling pathway in your brain was already strong, you know, maybe partly inherited or sort of from the childhood that you had. So that was the sort of path of least resistance for you. It sounds like overcoming your anxiety was that a little bit harder work for you. The opportunity was there in your brain, but you really had to make those connections.
Yes.
And then there is the option where you actually like create new neurons from embryonic neurons and then connect them up and then create new pathways. And for you, that was things like not being athletic or, you know, not being as good at other things as you were at storytelling. And you made the right choice by not thinking, okay, I'm going to try really, really hard to be athletic, because that would have taken so much effort that it would have detracted from other parts of your brain where it's easier to actually make big changes. What people used to call the weakness, which we now call the development area, is actually the hardest place to change your brain. So I think you made a, you know, you made a really good move by playing to your strengths, and the science really supports that.
Well, I think it did help me greatly to observe a lot of the young people around me. I could tell I was different from them in the sense of, as I think it was likely, I was on the autism spectrum. But I was seeing a lot of kids who struggled the most with direction. They were the kids who could do all these different categories fairly well. So there was always this tug of war of, what do I chase? What do I refine? And they were never sure. And I think when I observed that when those other kids would hit against a wall of pain or resistance, they would shrink back and turn to some other pursuit, whereas I wouldn't, not because I was stronger, but because I knew I only had the one path. And so, or I was convinced that I only had the one path. So that allowed me to push through when it got really painful, when it was terribly difficult I was so anxious, or I just couldn't stop these ticks and these sounds and squeaks that I would make. And then I also attribute it a great deal to encouragement. You know, I found in my lane of storytelling, I was being encouraged by adults and peers in that lane as a young person. And that encouragement was the balm, if you will, that really helped me through the most painful seasons and windows of development. And I think it's what's turned me into an encourager above all, you know, knowing that you don't know when you encounter another person, you don't know what walls they're up against, you don't know what their anxieties are, you don't know what their biggest issues are. And sometimes it just takes that extra really observant, pinpointed encouragement to push them through it so that they don't just shrink back from it and try to chase some other pathway that, as you're saying, if I'd had that tendency and chased baseball instead, I would have suffered even more because I didn't have natural talents there. I'd be trying to force myself into a place where I didn't necessarily fit.
I mean, not everybody has that single point of clarity like you had at such a young age.
True.
Where do you think that came from?
Well, I spoke of encouragement, and I would certainly say, you know, I have an old 1930s manual typewriter sitting right in front of me here in my office right now. It's always here. Since I was 11 years old, that typewriter has sat in my creative space. It's like my talisman, if you will. And that was a gift from my maternal grandfather. And I remember I grew up in Georgia, and we were out on a lake out in Georgia on his boat just a few years before he passed away. And for some reason, even though we had this large family, I was alone with him as a young man. I mean, it's so clear, such a clear memory. He turned to me and he said, "Mark, my boy, have you decided? What are you going to do with your life?" He's asking me this at 11. And I said, and no one had ever asked me that so pinpointedly. So I'd never shared, you know, these thoughts that I had of creativity and wanting to do this. So I said, "Well, honestly, Granddad, I want to write. I want to be a writer." And again, I can just picture the moment. This is, you know, I'm 52. This is 40 years ago. He turns to me and he goes, "No." I went, "What?" He goes, "You won't be a writer. You already are a writer. Every time you have opened your mouth and told me a story, it has been beautiful. And this is what you were built to do. You are already a writer. Just chase it." And it filled me with such familial pride and confidence. And I felt heard and I felt seen. And when we got back from that boating trip, and again, large family, so you're always in a big room with everybody. And my granddaddy pulls me aside. And he goes, "I need you to come out to the garage with me." We go out to the garage and he digs through some things. And then he walks back with this typewriter and he hands it to me. And he goes, "I know this doesn't work very well. It's much older than you, but I want you to write your masterpieces on this." And he gave me that gift. And, you know, for the next 5 years before I could afford my own electric typewriter, if that tells you how old I am, far before we had computers, I pounded out with my little 11-year-old fingers on this old rusty typewriter with ribbon. I pounded out short stories and one-act plays and comedic articles and, you know, things I thought was funny, and started entering contests and magazines, and never, ever looked back because somebody that I admired was willing to risk not just encouraging me in a generic safe sense, but daring to encourage me in a specific observed sense. And that made all the difference.
You're really bringing back memories for me. I think there's definitely something about grandparents where they don't have to be so involved in the day-to-day kind of, you know, parenting, but they can really be there in terms of legacy. And that's just such a gift. And I have a similar experience from my grandparents. But as you're speaking, the thought that came into my head was, when did you first realize that you're funny?
Well, you know, when you start making people laugh on a regular basis, you know, everybody tries to make everyone laugh when you're growing up. So for a while, you don't notice it. And then at some point, I became aware that the laughs were bigger, right? I mean, I absolutely know how I refine my sense of humor. Like I said, I was not an athlete. So I was not, you know, I was not the muscular guy. I was not the biggest, tallest, manliest guy. I wasn't the guy that got all the girls, but I had the mouth. So when I would get bullied, when people in the neighborhood would try and pick on me, I knew I couldn't punch them. I knew I couldn't wrestle them to the ground. I knew I couldn't hurt them. But man, could I slay with the insults. And I, you know, I'm not necessarily proud of it. I'm proud I didn't get beaten up. But I mean, I could get vicious, like very observant, very pinpointed, hit a bully where it hurt and get everybody else around laughing. And for me, that was a beautiful thing because then they would stop messing with me because they didn't want to be humiliated. And that was my safety net. That was the one thing that kept me from being beaten to a pulp, you know, in school. And so as I got older, I made a vow to, you know, to only jab with close friends who would see it as playful and to kind of, mm-hmm. you know, move away, to evolve and move out of the cruelness. I did stand-up comedy for many, many years, and I really worked hard to not be a guy who ripped apart the people in the audience that, you know, started throwing comments your way. I didn't want to be that guy, but it took a lot of work. Because when you have a natural talent of humor, the go-to is to use it as a weapon of choice when you have to. And so when you are attacked, it's the hardest thing in the world to not pull that tool out and get mean with it, right? It's much more difficult to be patient and work on the craft and use it as an uplifter and as a way to make people's day and moment better. And, you know, so that's constantly yin and yang. So, I mean, I think the mixture of those two, the realizing I was getting bigger laughs than the average person, and then realizing that it was my go-to tool, that's when I thought, you know, this may need to be a key part of my storytelling. And it has been. I mean, that, you know, for my early career, that's what got me the larger jobs, was I could use humor effectively where other writers struggled in that area.
Wow. Two thoughts. One is, I'm glad I've never been on the receiving end of that vicious tongue in terms of...
Never, Tara.
I know. And then two, when did you realize that this was also a way to get all the girls?
Well, I never was the person who could get all the girls, and that's probably a good thing. You know, I was very patient. I was one of those individuals who... By the time I graduated high school, I had never had a girlfriend. I was every girl's best buddy. I was that guy in all the romantic comedies that's like, you go get him, girl. That was always me. You know, they just never, there were girls I was interested in, but they never saw me that way, ever. I was the safe guy. I was the fun guy. I was the guy they could open up and talk to. And then when I got to college, all of a sudden, no one there had seen me grow up awkwardly with tics and with stutters and with anxiety. I was suddenly this person who was not all the way there, coming into my own. You know, college was a huge part of how I grew. You know, I took my first 2 years, I took every course possible in oral interpretation of literature, public speaking, children's education, you know, everything I could that was putting me in a position to have to get in front of people with my creativity. But I already had a great deal of confidence from how much I'd worked on it in high school. And so as I'm coming into college with all this confidence and able to make people laugh, then suddenly I was drawing the girls. But I was choosy. You know, I wasn't the person who just dated a different person all the time. I would go without a date for 9 months and then pinpoint who I was interested in, and then I would date them for like 6 months. So by the time I met my wife, which was well after college, my wife is wonderful and she is more than my match. She is so sharp, so smart, just everything about her is just wonderful. By the time I met her, I had probably 4 serious girlfriends before that, but those are 4 of maybe 6 girls I'd ever even gone out with once. So I was a different sort of dater, if you will. I wasn't the, you know, Girl of Week Club.
I love that we went into the specific details and numbers of your dating history.
Why not, you know? We'll go through you later.
Yeah, why not? That could take a lot longer.
Oh, dear.
What I was thinking was interesting is that you had a long period of time as a young child where you were kind of reinventing yourself internally. Mm-hmm. And then when you went to college, it was the context and the environment that allowed you to reinvent yourself kind of further.
Yes.
We're about to go into a break, but when we come back from the break, I'd love to dig into that and find out if there were other times, whether it was the environment or the people or the place, that were like conduits for you to reinvent yourself as you then, you know, navigated your adult life.
Absolutely.
You're listening to Reinvent Yourself with Dr. Tara. We'll be right back. Reinvent Yourself with Dr. Tara is proudly supported by Emotional Well-Being by Raffles Hotels. Raffles Hotels and Resorts. True luxury is not just about what you do. It's about how we make you feel.
This is Dr. Tara. And if I'm going to stay at a hotel, it needs to be rejuvenating. I travel a lot, and even a single night away from home can be exhausting. I need a place to rest my head that is deeply invested in creating a destination designed for my well-being. That is why my best night's sleep away from home is when I stay at a Raffles hotel. Raffles takes a holistic approach to well-being, where guests are intuitively guided through thoughtfully curated experiences, spaces, and rituals, bringing a sense of wellness. Raffles is intentional when it comes to design for harmony and nutrition for pleasure, carefully curating a ritual program with a series of collaborators. The end result is the breath of fresh oxygen you need when away, whether for business or escape. This focus on emotional well-being is precisely what makes Raffles Hotels and Resorts a perfect partner to my podcast, as their focus and desire is for you to live your very best life.
For more information on Raffles Hotels and Resorts, including details about their curated well-being programs, simply visit raffles.com today. That's raffles.com. Raffles, true luxury is not just about what you do. It's about how we make you feel. And now, back to the conversation.
Mark, so you took us all the way up to your college days.
Yes.
And I'm just wondering, within which different contexts and environments, how many times do you think you've reinvented yourself during your life?
Well, you know, I've talked about I'm in the business of storytelling and the art of storytelling. But let's face it, if you want to do it for a living, it's both. And I think anyone in this line of business or art would tell you you're reinventing yourself constantly. Because there are so many mediums of storytelling that, number one, are a draw. You want to, if you're a person like me, you want to reach as many audiences as possible. So I've worked successfully in film, in television, in children's entertainment, in published books, in podcasts, in audio material, songs and comedy for the recorded comedy and that sort of thing. So for me, it's always been project to project. How do I need to evolve? What new skills do I need to learn in two lanes, in storytelling and in the business of getting the storytelling effectively made? That's the role of being a producer, being a director. You know, when I was coming out of school, I had worked on all these skills to be able to communicate my stories well and to do the craft of the storytelling. So, if you will, pitching and crafting. But I had no idea that I would eventually be a producer, a director, all these things that I am now. It was as confidence built upon confidence built upon confidence. As failures turned to learning and as successes turned to opportunity, eventually a further, better, bigger version of storytelling would arise that I could not say yes to if I didn't reinvent myself. And so that linear desire to tell the best stories in the best ways that would reach the most people, that linear non-changing passion forced continual reinvention. So the pathway was clear, but the mechanisms, the technology evolving, audiences changing, mediums developing that didn't exist when I was young, social media and streaming and all these things, It requires constant reinvention. And so I would say the difference between me and probably most of the individuals you talk to is there's probably only a handful of times in my life where I've thought to myself, I have to completely pivot. I have to do things a different way to be a success. That's only happened a couple of times, a full awareness of it. But the evolution side of it, here we go. Don't know how to do this? Got to know how to do this. That's probably two, three times a year for 30 years in the business now.
I love that. I I would say the same. There are, you know, a couple of major times where I've reinvented myself, probably the biggest one being leaving practicing as a medical doctor and starting up my coaching business.
Yes.
But then in the coaching business, which has now been twice as long as how long I was a doctor, continually looking at the trends, you know, what's changing, what I can offer that's new.
Right.
So quite a similar story.
Isn't that interesting? The science doesn't change. But the technology and your awareness of the science and your means of communicating the science, all those things evolve. Well, you know, I'm working with silly putty, something that's always bendable. You're working with a rock, an idea that doesn't change, and yet you have to evolve, you have to transform as much as I do. Isn't that fascinating?
That's actually not true, Mark, because neuroscience has actually changed a lot. And yeah, that has been to do with the advent of scanning technologies and things.
Yes.
But if you think about how, you know, this whole left brain, right brain hypothesis was so pervasive for decades.
Right.
And now we're really trying to, and there's still a lot of resistance against it, help people to understand that it's systems that travel around the brain in all different directions.
Yeah.
Concepts such as amygdala hijack, which is that, you know, my emotions completely flooded my brain and I couldn't be responsible for the way that I behaved.
Hmm.
You know, sort of, that's really applicable to coaching because there was a lot of bad leadership behavior that was explained by that. And then a beautiful analogy that I love, because, you know, I believe that science is an art as well, is that it's not like a coach with wild horses that just drag you away. It's more like you're a chef and you have flour, eggs, butter, milk, and sugar.
Yes.
And you can decide what you make with those ingredients. You can make a cake or you can make a scrambled egg.
Right.
So I think it's a bit of both. I mean, you know, the foundation of science may not have changed much, but a lot of what we understand about it has changed. And then you're right. For me, it was like how I applied that to executives and
yes. And that is really more
education.
What I mean. The,
yeah.
The truths don't change, but our awareness of them certainly does.
Yeah. And I think even that analogy that you used about a rock versus silly putty, mm-hmm. you know, I think a huge advantage in life, if you want to evolve in the way that, you know, we're both giving examples of, is that you have to be silly putty. You can't be a rock.
Exactly. Well, and I think meeting you, I know that meeting you has transformed me in so many ways because I think people inherently realize that I have to be silly putty to survive, to thrive, to succeed. But that doesn't equate to people feeling like they are actually able to be silly putty. And what you've revealed to me personally, your studies in neuroflexibility has really opened my mind up to consistently fight that urge to believe that I can't, right? We all have an urge to think, well, no, I'm too set in my ways. I can't change there. This is too habitual for me. I'm too old. I'm too male. I'm too whatever. And it really was more than eye-opening. It was very life-changing for you to come in and not just be a self-help guru saying, oh, sure you can, but to come in and say, I have the science to prove that you can. Because that's what people like me need. We simply need someone to say it factually can be done, and then I'll do the work. And I'll dig in and I'll get to it. It's that self-deception. It's that doubt. It's that belief that this message is for everyone except me that holds me back. And I think that's what holds most people back, which is why you are so refreshing and so empowering, because nobody can say that. Nobody can say that once they hear what you have to offer on the subject. It's powerful.
Thank you so much. And I have heard that since I wrote The Source, that it was the science that made people actually act on, you know, trying to make changes. And that's...
Yes.
That's very affirming for me, you know, given all the studying that I've done, that it is really making a difference to people's lives. And that's why I'm doing the podcast and doing the show.
Absolutely.
To help people understand that sort of more conversationally and more visually.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, like you, I've also tried to work through different mediums to reach people because, you know, people's brains accept information in such different ways.
Yes.
And I just want to tie this back to something else that you said that really resonated with me, which was about failures becoming learning opportunities. Mm. There's quite a well-known phrase, which is, there's no such thing as a failure unless you don't learn something from
right.
it, or there's no such thing as a mistake unless you don't learn something from it. And for me, that was quite theoretical for a while until I went into a completely new career and had to feel my way around and, you know, I'm sure made a lot of mistakes. And really, it kind of aligned like deep down in my brain and my heart that you have to learn something every time,
yes.
you know, something doesn't go the way that you wanted it to. And And that, in fact, that is such a driver for evolution and moving forward. Mm-hmm. Because you've said, you know, and I agree with what you said, that people think that they can't change. But yes. I think there's also another issue just as strong, which is people don't want to, even if they're not happy in the situation yes. that they're in, even if they hate their job, even if they're not fulfilled in their relationship, even if they're not as healthy as they'd like to be, it's easier to stay safe in the situation that yes. you're in. And to me, that's the core message of Reinvent Yourself, which is that you've got to find that spark somewhere, even if it's going to be hard, that you do want to change. Because I'd like to think, I mean, I do believe that people don't realize how amazing their brain is, but I'd like to believe that people do think that they could do it, mm-hmm. but it's the choice.
Well, and I'm a huge proponent of ownership over blame. And I say this to the people that I work with. You're going to make mistakes. You're going to have what you define as failures. No failure is a failure unless you die that way. You know, it just feeds the next thing. But you can respond to it one of two ways. You can own what happened, the negative experience, the bad choice, what have you, or you can blame. And the big danger in that is if you own it, there is always something to learn. And if you own it, you will find that thing to learn. But if you blame, you will miss that thing to learn. And that will then perpetuate more failure because, you know, it is the blamers who keep running against the same errors and the same people that frustrate them because they're just not learning. They're not evolving. They're not reinventing. And, you know, again, that's hard. It's easy to say, it's hard to live when you butt up against a wall that, you know, that you caused or you took part in and you realize that was a mistake, that was an error, that was a failure. It's hard to own it and learn from it. I'm old enough to know that if you don't, you're just going to meet the same frustration again and again and again.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's a point in most people's lives where we have to realize that we're the common denominator in a recurring pattern.
That's exactly right.
And
wow,
it's not
ouch.
Always even in the same area. Yeah, I know. It's not even always in the same area of your life. Like one of the things that I do with my coaching clients is that I help to raise patterns for them across their work relationships, personal, you know, sort of romantic relationships, friendships, sporting relationships, yeah. and help them to see that there might be a recurring pattern across those different areas of their life, but also like throughout the past of their life as well. Yeah. And I particularly do a lot of work in financial services. And I even try to dig down into the ways that people trade and invest and see if that pattern occurs in the rest of their life. That was quite a game changer. And so, yeah, the repeated pattern thing is super interesting. And I would encourage our listeners to do that exercise at home. Think about the patterns that come up across their life in terms of the different types of relationships, but also, you know, what's happened in the past.
Yeah. Well, you'll meet a lot of people. You'll hear that phrase, public success, private failure. And sometimes it will flip-flop. And there will be individuals who have through experience, figured out exactly the successful, healthy way to run one avenue of their life. And they aren't even cognizant of the fact that they are butting against that wisdom in the other facet of their life. You know, the willingness to take a look at each lane and, okay, maybe my business self isn't broken, but maybe my relational self is. And maybe my relational self outside my family is not broken, but my relational self within my family is. And, you know, a part of reinvention mm-hmm. is taking a good assessment of what does work and what does not work and trying to discover how to bleed the positive over into other lanes of our life. But sometimes we're blind to that. It's so hard to translate that or to even see it.
That's so interesting. I mean, potentially a massive topic because, you know, I'm really big on sort of boundary work, which is where do you draw the line,
yes.
you know, with certain people, certain situations. And I think it's really important to realize that that can be very different in those different areas of your life. So where you say, you know, my relationships aren't broken outside my family, but they might be inside my family. I mean, family dynamics is so complex.
Oh, yes.
And, you know, so where you draw that line of what sort of behavior you tolerate in different relationships, I think it's not one size fits all. So you also have to have the flexibility to understand that it's different in this situation or with that person. Right. And be, you know, flexible on all those sort of borders of your life. It's not one size fits all. And that's part of neuroflexibility as well.
I'm convinced, and of course I fall prey to this same thing as anyone does, that there's something in this idea, because we all are challenged in our relationships with our families, right? More than we are with peers, with friends, with people in our line of business, with neighbors. And there's something in that idea that we're never going to be able to undo the fact that this small group of people have seen the worst of us. They've seen us at our most immature. They've seen us changing, evolving. They've seen all the reinventions. And as much as we cannot have grace for one another's, what we've observed in one another, I tend to see that the most broken part of family relationships is that and I'm speaking of the universal I, each of us struggle to have grace for the family that has seen us at our worst, right? If that makes sense.
And we've seen it
that way. Yes, that it's hard for me to get over the fact that I don't struggle as much to have grace for the failings I've seen in my siblings and parents. I don't have grace for knowing they've seen it in me. Does that make sense? And so much of the tension is that I don't like that people exist who have seen the worst of me. We each think it's what they're thinking about us, but it's really quite the opposite. It's what we are assuming is being thrust on us because we know all the warts and all. And that can be so damaging in that extended family dynamic, because we come into every conversation loaded with knowing they have all this ammo per se that they may never have used, but we come in it guarded. We come into it pre-offended is a word I coined. We come into conversations pre-offended because of you know, our knowledge of what they have on us. And grace has to be an enormous part if we want to evolve, if we want to transform, especially in those oldest, most important, most damaged relationships. We have to develop grace for others, grace for ourselves, a willingness to extend, because it's more than love, and it's not quite forgiveness. It's an understanding that it's okay that I know the worst of you and that you know the worst of me, and that is not everything that we believe about each other.
This is what I love about this show. There's so much that I can share from the science, but I've never quite heard anybody put that in that way. And what I'm hearing is, you know, everything very deeply that you've shared is that it's almost like you can't really reinvent yourself with your family that you grew up with because they can't unsee what they've seen.
They know all the reinventions. Everyone you've tried, everyone you've succeeded, everyone you failed. And that's okay. Someone needs to know you that well, right? I mean, someone needs to know your whole story other than you. But we don't, that's not safe. That doesn't feel safe. And so we go in, like I said, pre-offended, pre-hurt, pre-guarded. I'm talking about myself. I shouldn't say we, but you find yourself, when you have a bad conversation with family, it's because you've pre-constructed parameters around the conversation that may very well not even exist.
Or, you know, I mean, they may exist for some people, because I think a classic line that you get from your family, perhaps more than anybody else, is, oh, you've always been that way.
Oh, yes.
You know, and if you've worked to reinvent that, but there's somebody out there who's able to say, well, that's what you're really like. That's what you've always been like.
Right.
That is, of course, you'd be pre-offended and offended and post-offended.
Oh, yeah.
If that's not what you want to be like anymore. And especially if you don't believe that you are like that anymore, and that people who meet you after a certain point in time see you as very differently to that. But yeah, there are these ghosts almost, whether it's actual family members or your own memories of yourself.
I had, as you would say, as you Brits would say, I had a row with my one of my sons.
Row.
A row. They say a row. Well, I had a row. I was out on the river with an oar. I had a row. And then I had an argument. I had a row with one of my adult sons the other day. And, you know, it was one of those moments that you have a tense moment with someone that you love dearly and you don't even know where it came from. You're like, I didn't want that to go that way. Where did that come from? And an assessment after, which I did apologize for, I realized it was from my own brokenness, that I had convinced myself in this moment that the very thing that that had frustrated me so much that my father would believe about me or think about me. He was reacting to me as if I was having those attitudes towards him, and it was offending me so deeply that I would ever have the attitudes towards him that I perceived, doesn't even mean I'm right on this end, that I perceived my father had towards me that were hurtful. And I didn't even realize that was all the interpretation that was happening in the moment, but all that, you know, and I have a good relationship with my dad now, but I mean, all that damage, all of that history, all of those different reinventions, all that awareness of everything everyone's ever been, me knowing everything about my son, him knowing everything about me, it all collided in this moment. And the net result was I said things and acted in a way that I didn't want to. And I didn't know where it came from. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when I reassessed it, I felt terrible. But, you know, that's where that comes into play, where you realize, wow, I really have to work on my heart. I have to work on it. That's where I need reinvention. You know, I've got to reinvent my choice of present perspective of the people who've known every version of me, and not wrap up my present perspective in every perspective that ever existed about that father, that son, that brother. You know, that's hard work. That's therapy is what it is. But I think that's one of the most pivotal things you can do in the reinvention process, because it has to start at the core of your damage and your attitudes, the daily way that you respond to people. You know, me trying to identify, okay, I can identify today three times that I kind of shrinked up and reacted. Maybe I didn't say anything negative, but I felt something negative by the way someone responded to me. Why? What are the common denominators in those three moments that I got super guarded and stressed and tense? You know, and trying to know myself a little bit better and identify, you know, what is it about me that's still a bit broken, that still needs to have grace and still needs to do a little bit of sleuthing, a little bit of detective work on where Mark Steele is right now, where my headspace is right now, and why I had a disproportionate emotional response to what was actually happening in the moment.
Mark, you have such a big heart, and thank you so much for sharing that, because, you know, we're all guilty of that. And, you know, what I see in psychiatry clinic and in coaching is that so many people aren't even there yet that they could realize that.
Wow.
And they would have gone with that moment, and that would dictate the rest of what happened in the relationship with the son, the father, everyone.
Right.
It's a huge topic to get into. So we're going to go into a quick break, and I'm going to leave you with one of my favorite quotes, which is, "We don't see the world how it is. We see the world how we are."
Wow.
We'll be back in a few minutes. Thank you for being with Mark and I, Dr. Tara, on Reinvent Yourself.
You're listening to Reinvent Yourself with Dr. Tara. We'll be right back. Dr. Tara's revolutionary take on neuroplasticity is having a profound impact on thousands and thousands of listeners and readers worldwide. If you are one of the many who are truly looking to reinvent yourself, but you don't know where to start, look no further than the MIT Executive Education Program. The Massachusetts Institute of Technology offers courses both in person and online that can give you a jumpstart on true transformation. In fact, Dr. Tara offers a 6-week online MIT course called Neuroscience for Business, a program she designed specifically for leaders. It will challenge your brain to come at business and teamwork from a completely different perspective. For more information on MIT Executive Education, including details about Dr. Tara's 6-week course, Neuroscience for Business, simply visit executive.mit.edu today. That's executive.mit.edu. An extraordinary first step toward reinventing yourself. Just another reason why Reinvent Yourself with Dr. Tara is proud to be supported by MIT. MIT, join us in building a better world. And now, back to the conversation.
Welcome back to Reinvent Yourself with Dr. Tara. I'm here today with Mark Steele, and we've had a fascinating conversation so far. So I'm going to leave him with one thought-provoking question that I'm sure we'd all like to hear the answer to. What are your aspirations for your children, and how do these relate to any hopes or regrets from your own childhood?
Heavy. Well, I think a lot about this. I mean, I haven't just thought a lot about this. I I had a storied childhood. My parents loved me. My parents weren't necessarily raised in homes that taught them how to love children. So they did their absolute best. And like I said, I have a lot of grace for it. But I did feel very lost and misunderstood quite a bit. And I don't put that on my parents because they were very loving and they tried very hard in every way that they could. You know, as I said, I think I was likely on the spectrum. I was very quirky. I wasn't always, especially very, very young, I wasn't always the easiest person to be around because of my anxiety and because of whatever I had that was not diagnosed at the time. It was very, very difficult in retrospect to have issues and be undiagnosed. That's why I'm so grateful for today's science. And, you know, my own kids, I have two special needs kids. They're both on the autism spectrum. I have a 23-year-old with Asperger's. And I have a 12-year-old who's also on the autism spectrum, but very different from Asperger's. Our 12-year-old was diagnosed when he was 2, the first person in our entire family line to be diagnosed on the autism spectrum. Though the unpacking of it over the following years, as scary as it was to get that diagnosis and not know what it meant, but to just know at the time when he was 2 that he did not have language, he was inconsolable, angry all the time because we couldn't understand his wants or needs. He was frustrated all the time. When we began to have the helps and the therapies and the knowledge, the diagnosis, it transformed our lives. But it also revealed to us how much of our family line in our past didn't have the diagnosis we needed. We didn't find out our 23-year-old had Asperger's till he was in high school because our eyes weren't open to autism until our 2-year-old, who was a decade behind. And we did not know that what I struggled with was probably diagnosable. And family line before me was probably diagnosable. And so not having answers equals not knowing who you are. And not knowing who you are as a young person. Not, and I'm not saying that a diagnosis defines a person. Being on the autism spectrum does not begin to paint the beautiful colors and flavors of my kids. And they have triumphed and been championed. And because of the diligent work of my wife, and I will say it, my own diligent work, and first and foremost, their diligent work, they have become so much more than anyone ever told us they would be. They're some of the greatest, brightest, creative, strong people I know. But boy, has it taught me how feeling misunderstood, mislabeled, and having no answers for your dysfunction or frustrations, how heavy that can weigh on a person. I think back to so many kids, I'm just talking specifically about autism spectrum, who grew up with me, how many would have just been labeled problem students, maybe ADD, maybe dyslexic, but they wouldn't have fit into the school system, they wouldn't have fit into the social system, and therefore they would have suffered and not understood why. And back when I was growing up, you'd be told, you're weird. Adults would tell you, you're weird. You're so strange. Would you just stop it with all the weird noises? And can you anything that could come from the clarity, the beautiful clarity of a diagnosis? And then we've also found, and this is a little sidetrack here, but I'm so grateful to a man that I've never met, a filmmaker and a storyteller named Jason Kadams. And some people may know that name. He was the showrunner for Friday Night Lights, and he was the showrunner for a television show called Parenthood that my wife and I watched religiously. And the show Parenthood, one of the aspects of that show was it showed in great, accurate detail two young parents raising a child on the autism spectrum. And that story was based explicitly on Jason Kadams' experience with his wife raising their own son on the autism spectrum. So a very risky and brave thing to do, to put his and his wife's own journey on television. But I will tell you that the day that our son was diagnosed with being on the autism spectrum, the only thing that was an anchor for my wife and I is that we had watched in detail someone else's journey with their own real life son on the spectrum play out on television, that it gave us some taste of what we might have in front of us, and that the difference between that and oblivion, cluelessness, no insight is mammoth. And it caused my wife and I both to embrace the diagnosis embrace the helps, the medications, the therapies, and really we attribute that to a large part of our son's growth, that and his own hard work. We've seen so many other married couples get a diagnosis on the autism spectrum, and what we see happen so often is the mother, the wife, digs in to learn, digs in to get the child what they need, and most of the time, yep. the father says, I don't believe it, it's bunk, this is nonsense, this is not it, because males are built to feel like they have to solve things, and the autism spectrum is not something you solve, it's something you maneuver. The universe of your family shifts and moves around new knowledge and new experience, as opposed to you saying, child, fit to my universe. Child, fit into the way I like to do things. And we see those marriages when there's that disagreement, we see them fall apart. We see the child not get what they need. So what I'm a proponent for all the time is, dads, step back from your dadness and recenter the universe around what your child needs. Go get the diagnosis. Trust the experts. There's a beautiful path. It's not the path you thought you were going to be on, but there's a beautiful, profound path awaiting you if you will embrace it. And I mean, that's what I would say, because that's how I feel I suffered as a young person myself. And so I still make mistakes, your original question, with my own kids. But I try so hard, instead of saying, child, fit into my universe, I try so hard, and I've tried since they were born, to discover their universe. What is it that makes each of my children tick, come alive, grow? What are their desires? I can't expect my kids to revolve around my one thing that I knew I was a storyteller and I chased just that. I have to sleuth out what's their one thing. And I have to romance that. I have to wrap myself around that and draw them into the family unit. You know, I grew up in an era when dads were taught, nope, you tell your kids dad's way is the highway. Everybody figures out dad's way and everybody's lines up like Captain Von Trapp. And just you do dad's way or you're out. And that's why you've got so many damaged relationships, so many people who were lost and didn't know their pathway. Yeah. So I'm not perfect at it by any means, but that's my attempt. That's how I try to change, you know, my struggles as a young person and where I felt lost and where I felt unknown. I try to change that trajectory for my own kids. And as any man, I fail as much as I succeed, but I'm always trying.
Mark, thank you so much. I mean, I've known you for a while and we're friends, but I've heard some things I've never heard before and I didn't think I would hear. And you took us on such an emotional journey that I forgot for quite a few minutes that we were recording a podcast and I was just fully immersed in what you were saying. And, you know, I had a few thoughts, which is that I do believe that neuroplasticity offers hope and grace. And that's why I do everything that I do.
Yes.
But I think that when I hear little stories like we had watched Parenthood, I just know that whether you think it's God or the universe or magic, that there's something way bigger than science out there. And that's the journey that I'm on, you know, having been a doctor and a scientist for my whole adult life, just really being open to the fact that there's something currently inexplicable that's bigger than that and greater than that. And that also offers hope and grace and perhaps much more.
And that's so important in that moment of getting that diagnosis. But having had watched that show in the past, we felt somehow known, right? As you're saying, we felt somehow like we weren't on our own. We weren't lost in this new mystery thing we were going to have to face. And that struck us, even though it was such an emotional moment and so hard, that struck us as so beautiful, you know, because those things, that's where I talk about grace. Those things don't have to happen in life. Those are beautiful things that that I don't think we necessarily take the time. You know, I do believe it's God, but different people think it's different things. And we have to take that moment to absorb that and look at the world around us and not just dwell in our, well, things are unfair. My situation's unfair and everything's rough and tough and all that. We have to give ourselves the grace of going, you know what? I do feel known. I do feel like something was looking out for me. Right? And I think that's important.
I think it's so important. And it really brings up something else for me, which is that many of my close friends from high school times all the way up to you are in the film and TV industry. And so over the decades, I've had a few comments from people saying, what you do is so worthwhile. And I just make TV shows. And I've always said that when I go to the cinema or I watch a movie or I go to the theater, it's like a higher power. It's kind of like we have our basic needs and then there's something that's in the arts and culture that's so beautiful that that's what makes a human experience. And, you know, you've just given me another example of that. So,
well, thank you for saying that. I mean,
thank you so much for everything. I could talk to you forever.
Well, I'm sure we will. I mean, offline. But I did want to say one last thing about storytelling. That is, you know, I do feel that it is as important. And I wish more storytellers felt that it was culturally. Because no politician, no preacher, no teacher, no parent can do what we can do as storytellers. And that is reflect upon an audience, a world where they see themselves and feel heard and known. But then in the context of the same story, talk about neuroplasticity, they see themselves differently. They make an unconscious choice before the end of the story that they want to pivot their life to be better than what they see on screen or to not be worse like they're seeing on the screen. That we're able to, by reflecting society back upon themselves and then taking them on a journey, change people's minds, change people's hearts, change people's actions. And I've seen it happen. And we don't do that. We're not trying to manipulate things. We're not trying to force any teaching. We're just reflecting the world back on people and showing them the way the world works. And when you do that outside of the context of a lecture, people absorb it and make up their own mind that they want to improve, transform, reinvent themselves inch by inch by inch.
Yeah, we're basically sharing some like common human experiences. And that's why I love hearing people's, you know, true deep stories like the one that you've shared today with so much grace. Thank you so much, Mark.
Thank you.
That's all for this episode of Reinvent Yourself. Remember, no matter your mindset or stage of life, any brain, even your brain, can change. Even you can reinvent yourself. I'm Dr. Tara, and I'll see you next time.
If you have a question or comment for Dr. Tara, email or send an audio recording of your question to Dr. Tara at knox.studio. Dr. Tara's latest book, The Source, is available wherever books are sold. This has been Reinvent Yourself with Dr. Tara, a Knox Studios podcast. All rights 2023 Knox Studios. Produced by Mark Steele, Nadir Tavangar, Shahada Kari, and Jason Bashour. Written by Dr. Tara Swart-Bieber and Mark Steele. Engineered and sound designed by Knox Studios. Original music composed and produced by Sundry Souls.